You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
In 2004, a poll of artists, historians, critics, and curators asked what was the most influential artwork of the last 100 years. You know what they said?
Wait, I'm on the edge of my seat. What did they say? I mean, it depends on what seat we're talking about, though, when it comes to this artwork, I guess.
I see what you did there. I appreciate it.
I worked on that.
Yeah. I'm glad one of us thought
it. I feel like, who art Ed?
I'm trying to spice it.
Who art Ed? Mr. Wood, art Ed me.
Good. Either way, it works on art. So many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, the podcast where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me today is Jeff Arndt, the art teacher from Ranch View Elementary. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back.
You can find a picture of the work being discussed this week and every week on the website whoartedpodcast.com, as well as linked in the show notes. Now, we're going to start season two with a deep dive into the piece dubbed The Most Influential Work of the 20th Century. It was Fountain from 1917 by Marcel Duchamp, or as my college roommate referred to him, the toilet guy.
I'm just going to go right out there with how much in awe I am just by those two dates that you mentioned, okay? If we go 2004, right?
Yeah.
And then the piece from 1917, that blows my mind to think that over that time frame we're going with this piece of artwork. That's unbelievable.
It really is. It really is on numerous levels. And for those who are not familiar with the piece, Fountain is one of the earliest ready-mades. And, you know, the ready-made was this idea of making art essentially out of found objects, you know, taking things that were already out there and then presenting it as a work of art rather than creating it and presenting it as a work of art. Marcel Duchamp is credited with creating the ready-made, although actually his creation of the ready-made, just like his creation of the fountain, is a little bit sort of suspect or questioned by a number of people. Nobody doubts that he coined the term the ready-made, but his first ready-made sculpture was a bottle rack in 1914. But a friend of his, Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Loringhaven, have you heard of her? You never heard of her. Most people have not heard of her. She was a Dada artist. She was an artist's model. She was a poet. And she was known for creating ready-made sculptures with things that she essentially scavenged. Like she was, you know, the pioneer of dumpster diving. And she was known and documented to have created ready-mades and presented ready-made sculptures, though she wasn't using that term, in 1913. So 1 year before Marcel Duchamp.
So quick question then.
Yeah.
Where's the line drawn or the connection between a ready-made versus a found object sculpture? Or are they interchangeable? Are they one and the same?
I think for all practical purposes, they're essentially the same. You know, I typically think of found objects as like the media or materials for a sculpture or for a work of art, whereas I think of the ready-made as presenting that manufactured object or, you know, that found object without real significant modification. So like I think of like Louise Nevelson, you know, she's taking all those scrap materials and she is building and constructing from those found objects. Whereas like Marcel Duchamp or Baroness Elsa just took a toilet, turned it on its side and signed it R. Mutt 1917. And that is another thing, actually. She, some historians say, actually created the fountain. Some people say not only did Duchamp not produce it, he says that he bought it from the, like, it was something Mott, like plumbing company, you know, he bought it from the factory. But actually, it was submitted anonymously using the pseudonym R. Mutt. And at the time, in 1917, Marcel Duchamp even wrote that one of my women friends using a masculine pseudonym, Richard Mutt, submitted a porcelain urinal to the Society of Independent Artists, to the Society of Independence show as a sculpture. So the big question that people have is, was he kind of admitting that he took credit for her work? Or did he use her to submit the piece to stay anonymous because he was on the board of the...
Well, there's so... I mean, and add that to the list of controversies surrounding this piece. I mean, it just grows and it grows and it grows.
It really does. And that really is somewhat like typical to form for Marcel Duchamp. Marcel Duchamp was born in France in 1887, and he came from an artistic family. Like, his grandfather was an artist. He was surrounded by his grandpa's art as he was growing up. Three of his siblings, two of his brothers and his sister, they all went on to be successful artists.
And I'm not too familiar with his family's artistic background as far as what were they making?
So like they were working in different media. Like, his grandfather was a sculptor. I want to say his brother was a printmaker, and they were successful artists, but they were not like, they weren't Picasso level successful artists. You know what I mean? But they were in that world. They were very well connected. They knew artists, you know, Marcel Duchamp knew Picabia and like all sorts of different people within the art world. And so like, I always find it funny because like, despite all of those connections, you know, he was on the board of the Society of Independent Artists. He created Society Anonyme. He advised people like Peggy Guggenheim and like directors of MoMA about their modern collections and the shows. He still liked to sort of portray himself as this like outsider and this rebel going after the art establishment. And it's just like, he was part of the art establishment.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are big roles, and those are some, you know, huge advisory positions and advisory roles that you're taking on.
Yeah. We all know, like, there's always a little bit of just like how you're choosing to portray yourself as a public figure. But it, like, he sort of pretended to be all the things that like Baroness Elsa really was. Like, she was this Dada artist who, like, from all accounts, lived that lifestyle on the streets of New York and was like arrested for like her just bonkers things that she was doing. Like, she wore like soup cans as jewelry and stuff like that.
And I think the big thing we have to think about, or at least keep in mind in the back of our heads, is time period and time frame.
Yeah. And you know, the Dada movement was in the very early 20th century, and it was largely a reaction against sort of rationalism in philosophy, but also like just the horrors of, that was the time of World War I, you know. The Dada movement was really just trying to be a little bit more playful and embrace random chance and embrace sort of absurdity and find humor. And that was very well suited to Marcel Duchamp. Duchamp studied art formally, but like even early in his career, he sort of made a living selling cartoons, and he liked things that were sort of visual puns and things like that. So he was from like the early days. And when I say early days, I'm talking probably like 1905, give or take. He was making artwork that was a little bit intellectual, but also a little bit playful.
Yeah.
And like one of those early works, like I said, he loved to think of himself as this rebel and outsider. So like one of the first pieces that he made his name for was the nude descending a staircase painting. And that was like one of his last paintings, because it wasn't his last, but he stopped painting when he was like 25 years old. And so that piece, I always think, like, when I think of, like, you know, a piece being controversial, you know, 100-year, early 20th century, I'm thinking like, okay, the nude is the part that people are going to have a problem with, but really it's the staircase. That's where the objection lied.
In viewing the piece, that's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, because like no matter what you call it, like you could call it like just shades of brown shapes, you know, because it's like you cannot tell at all what it is.
Then being a person that loves cubism and I love the concept and the ideas behind it, I get that when I look at this piece of artwork and I do think to myself, all right, I'm not seeing it at all. And I'm really trying to figure out here where are we going with this particular piece.
Yeah. And so with this piece, what he was doing was like in a sort of superficial way, it has some of the hallmarks of cubism because we see that fragmentation and those simple shapes. But he was trying to make it sort of kinetic and show that descending action. And it takes on this quality of like a stop motion or a film strip where the images are superimposed, layered on top of each other. And it becomes this like blurry mess because like in each frame, essentially you're capturing a different pose and they're in a different spot. And so there is this vague sense of descending action. And, you know, he put it up in the Paris Salon. What was it? Probably 1912. Give or take.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he put it up in the Paris, like submitted it for the Paris Salon. And accounts of that always talk about the controversy of displaying it. But like I said, he was kind of a well-connected person. So they came to him and said, like, they asked through his brothers, they said, can you talk to Marcel and tell him, like, can he change the title of this piece? And he refused. And I think the story says he walked into the salon and took it down during the exhibit and, you know, brought it home in a taxi. You know, flair for dramatic, yeah, all of that. But then, like, I read these art historians who say, like, the actual controversy was they didn't know if it should be displayed with the cubists or in another section. You know what I mean? It's like he's got
controversy too is almost unbelievable.
Yeah.
That would cause the controversy of then the artist coming in this big, you know, gesture of taking the piece down and storming out and leaving with it, you know?
Yeah. But it's like, which is like in so many ways, he's like the art world's troll, like, you know, decades before the internet. Cause he's just like, he's doing stuff just to agitate and like, and then taking his ball and going home.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, he put it up there and they displayed it and then he took it down. It, from what I understand, it wasn't well received. People did look at it and, you know, it just sort of, it was almost like a taboo. It broke the norms of what people were expecting. Even at a time when cubism was generally accepted, this just like, it didn't fit neatly in a category because it's got those cubist elements, but it's also a little bit futurist and people just didn't know what to make of it.
I can see the futurist aspect of it.
Yeah. because he's trying to capture that motion and everything like that. And then, you know, he brought it to New York where it was controversial, but I think better received at the Armory show. But again, like he's just, I feel like in a lot of ways, just hamming it up and playing it up as like the art world's bad boy displaying that.
No, well, giving him notoriety and beefing up his stature.
Yeah. So then if we fast forward a little bit, like I said, he sort of got away from what he referred to as retinal art, which like talked about that was his way of, I think it was a little bit derisive to be like, it's just about looks and it's so superficial. You know what I mean? But he started making ready-mades around like 1914. Like I said, 1914 was when he first did with a bottle rack, and he was on the board of the Society of Independent Artists, and they were putting on a salon that was supposed to be unjuried. So essentially any artist who paid the entry fee, they said they're going to display the work. And the story goes, Duchamp wanted to test if they would hold up to, like, if they would stand by the principles that they laid out for that show. Because the idea was the Society of Independent Artists wanted that exhibition to be more democratic. You know, any artist can put their work out there and then let the patrons decide what's good instead of having curators and a jury as gatekeepers and tastemakers. Does that make sense?
And if you think about time frame too, with where you're displaying art, what you have accessible to you, how big of an idea was that?
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
People are thinking about being more democratic, and what does that mean in different areas of their life? And so Duchamp takes what most people would say was probably like the most offensive thing he could think of, not just a ready-made, but a toilet. You know, it was straight from the manufacturer, so it didn't have that level of ick factor, but still people did find it to be, you know, offensive or gross, you know, too vulgar. Like I've read accounts that say like it seemed too vulgar and scandalous to women, although it was submitted by a woman, according to the accounts of that time.
So the norms that were breaking and ideas that we're kind of tackling are, there's so many different layers to it when you start putting it in those different lenses that it just amazes me. It doesn't amaze me how controversial this piece would have been during that time frame. Okay. I'm not surprised by that at all. I am absolutely astounded and just in awe of how that would have been received, knowing who submitted the piece versus who actually created the piece and the genders that were involved and how that was perceived during the time period.
Yeah, well, and it's weird because, like I said, nobody really knows who created the piece because, you know, one of the layers of complexity is Duchamp wrote in a letter to his sister that, like, a woman submitted this under the pseudonym. But at the same time, he later on claimed like he submitted it himself anonymously because he was on the board and wanted to test whether they would live up to what they were doing. So having a woman friend submitted on his behalf would make perfect sense if he were trying to stay anonymous. When it said it was submitted by a woman, was that Duchamp in his female persona or was it his friend? Nobody really knows. It's surprisingly murky.
Yeah.
But you know, most historians say he submitted it using a pseudonym, using that fake name of R. Mutt. And some people say that's referring to Mott, the company that produced it. And some people say that it's referring to like Mutt and Jeff Comics and things like that. But again, that's where that name is said to have come from. And the story goes that it was rejected and then smashed. But what really happened from what I've read is it wasn't prominently displayed. They kind of hid it in the back of the gallery behind like a wall, you know, so like nobody's seeing it.
Yeah.
But they still held true to have it. And then just conveniently enough, Duchamp makes this big spectacle of resigning from the board, and he happened to have, you know, Alfred Stieglitz there to photograph and document the piece. You know, like you have this prominent photographer documenting
to be there.
Just happened to be there. And so there's only one known photograph, that photograph of the original piece. Nobody really knows what happened to it after that. I mean, it probably was broken, whether it was like purposefully smashed or, you know, they just realized they were done with it and threw it away.
Sure.
But since then, like, there have been a number of replicas. I think like 17 replicas were made to Duchamp's specifications,
which I think is hysterical too. I mean, that is just so funny with the whole idea of the ready made and that when you start taking the the message that you're trying to create in general and the background with that, and then that kind of event unfolds and ends, and then it's all right, we're 17 more of these, let's make them, let's do it.
Well 17 more of these things that were mass produced to begin with for the museum, let's have these like artisanally crafted replicas instead of just, you know, going to the manufacturer who made the original. Like, it's kind of funny. So that's, I guess, the background to it. Looking at this original, what do you see? What's jumping out to you?
I think first and foremost, it's the shock factor. And it's the shock factor of what you're putting on that pedestal for the public to see.
Yeah.
The other thing that I see, or that I think of, is this gender role and the mystery that kind of surrounds this piece with, is it a woman creating the piece, but then having to have a male submit the actual piece? Is it a male creating the piece, but then possibly there's some mystery about him submitting the piece under, you know, female guise? I don't know. And then there's some irony involved in it as well, too. When I look at this particular piece and I think about somebody who's on the society's board, then trying to find cracks in the foundation, possibly not. And then the photographer aspect of it, too. There's just so many different things happening here. If I look at it from the lens of 2020, you know, it's not shocking to me. But if I try to put myself in that frame of reference of where we're at in this particular time period, I mean, it's a pretty remarkable piece.
Yeah, and it's funny because it is, you know, the aesthetics or the looks of it, it is just a pure white porcelain toilet that is turned over on its side. So you see it from a slightly different angle. It is quite literally upended. And sort of figuratively, it upended people's perceptions of what art is and what art could be. You know, as you were talking about your reactions to it, it was purely about the ideas. Everything you were describing, you know, to me, it was about the ideas of what does this represent in terms of the gender roles, the mystery of who created and submitted it, because it was delivered by a woman, but with a masculine pseudonym, Richard Mutt. And, you know, it may or may not have been created by a man, but like, it, to me, in some ways, it resonates a lot today because there is so much going on in discussing privilege in society and who gets credit for their work and their ideas and who is seen as brilliant and who is left to anonymous history.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I mean, and think about, especially right now in our period of time, gender privileges, right? Which you're just talking about different types of privileges.
Yeah.
And to think that in 1917, what was being done and discussed and where we're at now, how much have we gone forward or haven't?
I mean, at least now people are talking about the Baroness, and whether she created that piece or not, it is worth knowing she was doing the same thing. She was exploring the same ideas, and it seems like she was doing ready-mades a year before he was. And it's not like they did it independently of each other. They knew each other. It makes perfect sense that, like, and I hate to say it makes perfect sense, but it does make perfect sense that he was elevated in art history because he had the connections, because of his gender, because he came from Paris, you know, like, or he wasn't born in Paris. He was born in France, like a smaller town, but you know, he did work and exhibit in the Paris salons and stuff like that. Like, he had that artistic pedigree that people could be shocked by, but still accept. It wasn't that far of a leap.
No. And clearly he was able to, by all of the different connections that he had in different roles that he had as well, too.
He occupied that privileged space where he could do things that were outlandish without being seen as really threatening to people, because in so many other ways he embodied.
Absolutely. Otherwise, there'd be no way that he could be on or within these different groups and having these different positions.
Yeah. Like I said, getting back to this original piece, as I look at it from an aesthetic point of view, it seems very boring to me, you know? It's an overturned, mass-produced object. The only modification he made to it, or she made to it, whoever made it, was just signing it R. Mutt 1917. And then from there, it's just the ideas that it represents that seem the most interesting to me. And so to me, the most interesting thing, because I always think like art serves different functions, and people, the first instinct, and I think through a lot of history, the idea was art's function was to be beautiful. And then this took it to a whole other way. In a whole other way, saying it's just about the ideas. And I think that's the most important thing here, is because with the ready-made, what Duchamp and similarly minded artists were saying is the idea is the art. They put creativity as the central focus, defining something as a work of art. And at first, it seems like a ready-made is cheating. You know what I mean? Like on a gut level, as somebody who spent so much time practicing, honing my craft, I look at something that someone just literally plucked from a store or from a manufacturer or from a dumpster, signed and put on display, and it's like, it makes me want to scream.
Well, it's the classic, you know? You go into a gallery or a museum and you see this piece and you either hear somebody say, or you think to yourself, well, I could have done that.
Yeah. Like, I always just picture, like, Jackson Pollock, you know, walking into a gallery, like, I put this canvas on the floor in my barn. I spilled some paint on it. Give me some money, please. You know?
Well, at least he went and he spilled the paint all over it versus putting the urinal upside down and signing a name.
Is there more to that process, or no? But that's really what creates the interesting question to me, because then I start to think, well, at what point does something become a work of art that an artist created? I don't have to make my own paint because the way I spread the paint creates a picture that is something new and different from my own vision. But then you think about, well, someone who uses found objects and, you know, creates a sculpture from those objects, they're still arranging them and transforming them in a different way. So the challenge of the fountain is, like, fountain is getting us to question, like, how far can we go? Where does something begin to have been transformed enough by an artist for us to consider it a work of art?
Is there any debate if I've taken my sculpting capabilities and I've sculpted the exact replica of this and then sign my name on it versus just plucking one off the shelf and turning it over and signing my name on it? Or is that one and the same then?
See, I would argue that those are the same. And I would also argue that that's actually not creating art, even if you're hand sculpting it to make that replica, because you're not creating your own path. You're not being creative in that. You're demonstrating a skill and a technique that is impressive if you can do it well. You know what I mean? But that's purely craftsmanship. And what this piece gets us to do is think about, like, well, the really important transformation is being creative to get us to see something in a different way.
I see that idea, but can you argue?
Even if it's as minor as turning it on its side, signing it, and putting it in a different context. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like I said, I think it opens the door to a whole lot of terrible art, because a lot of people say, like, if you're gonna call that art, then anything is art. And I think that's true. I think pretty much anything is art. The question isn't, is it art or is it not? To me, the question is it good?
To what end?
Is it good art, you know?
Yeah. And okay. I just want to say, I would love to see this piece with the plumbing involved and water flowing through it. I think that would be another level of...
I think that'd be too much work for him.
Well, now we're really getting to something then.
So I'm wrapping it up. I want just a 3-point rating scale. And where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the Louvre? British for the bathroom.
Yeah.
There's the Louvre joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
I'm going to get into the gender thing a little bit more, and I'm going to say if it's Marcel doing all the work and putting it out there, I'm keeping it in the bathroom. But if I'm knowing that the Baroness is the person behind this, I'm throwing it right in the Louvre. It goes right in the museum for me.
Interesting.
I think in 1917, if a female artist is having these, you know, statements and thoughts and putting it out there, absolutely. Yeah. This is, to me, speaking volumes and really has something huge to say. Not that, you know, he doesn't have a concept behind it.
Certainly.
It just doesn't have the same impact for me coming from a male.
So you think this goes in the Louvre. I would put this in the lab for essentially the same rationale. Like, I think the ideas behind this are interesting. I think, you know, what it says about society, what people will accept, who gets elevated and who gets marginalized. You know, whether the Baroness created it or not, the fact that there is this mystery surrounding it, it starts a conversation. And that's what this piece really is all about, is starting that conversation. It's challenging our perceptions of what is and isn't art, what the artistic process is, what has to be done for something to be considered a work of art, you know. Is talent an unfair advantage? All those
sorts in connection, right?
Yeah. And so I think, like, the ideas of democracy and what can be displayed and what can be considered art are good. The other thing, the dimension that I think is lost in all of this, is there was an industrial designer who had to design that fixture, and like manufacturers, people working in the factory who had to physically produce it. And I feel like that's one of the things that bothers me most about ready-mades, is it takes credit away from the people who actually designed and produced the work.
Well, and especially in 1917, not knowing the process for creating one of these, a mass-produced kind of thing in a factory, I'd love to know how many people it took to actually make one during that time period. That'd be really interesting to know how many other hands had a part in creating this.
And I think I think for me, the thing that I would have found more interesting is if after this he had given proper attribution to everybody, you know, put the object on display, but also then recognize that art is in some ways a collaborative process where you're always taking other people's work. There is a some level of appropriation in pretty much everybody's work, unless you are, you know, those indigenous people who are creating their own pigments and creating their own stuff, like doing every level of it. Yeah, but for the rest of us, there is some level of appropriation. And I think this would have become even more interesting if there were attribution and recognition of that stuff in the ways that, again, you know, in its context, 1917, that would have been really advanced, because I think it wasn't until like the pop art movement that people started to say like commercial arts are not a lesser form.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And that's a comparison that I really draw upon when I think of this piece.
And that's probably why this is so influential.
Yeah.
Because it did change the way people thought about art. Thank you very much for taking the time to come in and talk to me about a toilet. This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted. If you found this tolerable, please like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week in the show notes, on Twitter at WoodArtEd, and on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.